I'm going to be just absolutely straight with you for a second. The world of cryptocurrencies is complicated, to say the least. And when you're trying to get involved for the first time, it can be incredibly, incredibly complicated. Trust me, I had to lose a lot of money in the process to understand how it actually worked. But have you ever wondered if you have, you know, had some thoughts about how to get involved with it, how to actually take advantage of the growth of cryptocurrency such as Bitcoin, but you haven't really known where to start? Well, I've got the group for you. BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. Their team handles the entire process and makes it incredibly easy. If you'd like to know more, you can go ahead and download your free copy of their Cryptocurrency IRA Investor's Guide at bittrustira.com/podcast. That's BitTrust, B-I-T, BitTrust, T-R-U-S-T, IRA.com/podcast. BitTrustIRA.com/podcast. Get their free guide downloaded today. Welcome to Rando Republic. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the one, the only Remso Republic podcast. I'm your host, as always, Remso W. Martinez. Go ahead and do me a favor, follow me on Twitter at Remso101. That's R-E-M-S-O-101. Go ahead and follow me there. I'll follow you back. That way, we'll go ahead and expand our ever-loving Liberty family. If you're a new listener, welcome. I say every episode is a great first episode to come into because I try and treat every time you know, I come on the air as the first time for somebody out there. And if you've been hanging out with us for a long, long time, well, you're in for another treat. But for those folks that are tuning in for the first time, we've got one mission here that we try and do well each and every episode. It's totally a ripoff, definitely cheesy, but hang around long enough and I bet you'll learn to love it. It's making freedom fun again. The concepts of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, the simple, simple concept that you do you, I do me, we don't use the government as a violent middleman, and we can go ahead living our, you know, happily, ignorantly blissful lives. And, that's common sense for you if you're listening to this of all shows. But sadly, for many of our, you know, great neighbors, brothers, sisters, Marxist aunts, Maoist uncles, all that jazz, it seems to be a radical concept. And we're here to talk about radical concepts in this episode. Now, one thing that I will say is if you did not listen to the episode before this where we talked about our topic today, which will be the Overton window, you might be a little bit confused if you're not a political science nerd like me and you had no life in college. But if you're listening to this and you're like, Overton window, what? Definitely go back and listen to the prior episode. This time we're going to be using this method of understanding political and social change in accordance to the first year of the Trump administration. Now, this episode's coming way after the one-year anniversary, and I did that on purpose because, of course, everybody in January was talking about, you know, what they thought. And frankly, here's what you have a lot of in what I call the conservative commentator complex, and you see this with pundits and commentators everywhere. You have a couple people that go ahead and set the talking points and set the standards and set the things you want to talk about, and then everyone just regurgitates them. So what I actually did was each time I saw somebody say something like, this is Trump's first year in review or something, I actually tuned out. And I didn't pay attention because I wanted to wait for that to kind of just smooth out a little bit so we can go ahead and come to you with some fresh perspectives. And we're only going to cover three areas: economics, foreign policy / diplomacy, and civil liberties here at home. And in order to do that tonight, brought back a good friend of the show, editor-in-chief of the Republican Standard, Mr. Sean Kenny. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
So we were actually chatting online as we were, you know, kind of discussing how this episode would go. And when I mentioned the Overton window, you kind of threw a wrench in my direction. You were like, ah, that thing's crap. Care to explain?
Well, it's really easy. So the Overton window, basically, you're just a very basic recap for those who are absolutely brand new to it. So if you kind of picture a rubber band in your hand, and you go ahead and you stretch it to the left in one direction, if you have put a little mark in the center of it, well, then the center of the conversation and the room for acceptable speech moves in that direction. If you pull it to the right, then the center, that box, that window for what's acceptable speech moves in the opposite direction as well. And so the theory behind the Overton window, obviously, is to go ahead and if you pull far enough to the left or you pull far enough to the right, you enable a greater degree of what is acceptable speech in order to move the center back to where you want it to be. So that's the window in a nutshell. A lot of people are enamored by this. It's certainly seen a lot of popularity in the Obama era, and certainly you'll see it in other quarters. I instinctively rebel against this, and there are a couple of reasons why. First and foremost is that if you're picturing that rubber band and you stretch it to the left and right, you stretch it too far, that rubber band snaps. And that's where you end up getting political upheaval and at times political violence. A good example of this, and yes, employee argument about Hitler if you want, but Weimar or Germany, 1920s and 1930s, you literally had both wings tug at the center so long that the center eventually broke, and one of the others, I mean, either the fascists or the socialists were going to win, and it just so happened at that time the fascists did. But that's what happens when you stretch too hard against the middle. So there's some utility in the thought experiment. But it's a terrible way to govern.
Exactly. And this model is kind of a recap. It was developed by John Overton back in 1992 over at the Mackinac Center. And essentially, you had two different thoughts of how this should be applied. It's either a model for understanding how to predict certain actions, or it was a way of understanding how to pull out social change. There's a good documentary, I think it was called Descent, which talked about the Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong several years ago. And you had two different social activists. You had one that was saying, we need to be peaceful, you know, the student rebellion, they were called the scholarists. And then you had the other side of scholarism, which was saying, we need to go ahead and, you know, start a war against the Chinese government. And they used the Overton window model as a, you know, what Sean mentioned, it was a any means necessary type of approach to go ahead and bring about the change that either side of that movement wanted. Think of it as like Professor X and Magneto, so to speak. So at times, depending on how you use it, you know, it's exactly what he said. You can go ahead and just completely burst that rubber band. But for the sake of today, what we're doing in reviewing the first full year of the Trump administration is we're simply using the Overton window as a model of understanding how have things shifted. As we go further, if we want to say things shifted in a more positive direction, we'll go ahead and say it shifted upwards. If we want to say it went in a more negative direction, we'll say it shifted downwards. And if it didn't shift, well, it didn't shift at all. So to kind of start things off, because this is one of the things that I feel that most conservatives were pretty torn on, and of course everyone is going to constantly complain and argue about everything, but the thing that's more passionate to me is economics. When it came to the Trump campaign, they constantly campaigned on fair trade, America first policies that would strengthen coal miners and blue collar pipe layers, and you know, bring jobs that have been taken away overseas and bring them back here through any means necessary, even if it meant slapping high tariffs on things, threatening to tax other stuff, and you name it. President Trump has tried to do that. We saw that with the carrier air situation within like 2 months of his presidency, and more recently we're seeing that now he's slapping massive like 30 to 50% tariffs on Chinese and South Korean solar panels. I mean, the numbers are insane. So when it came to this, I was thinking, okay, how have we moved? And when I look at that, those are some of the things that really bother me. When you look at the people that he's appointed to certain departments, we have the Secretary of the Labor Department that's attacking occupational licensure. So domestically, that's good because that allows more people to enter the workforce. When you do look at some of the jobs coming back, you know, there is a growing tech sector in the East Coast. You're having people that are working in the energy sector getting, you know, more hours, more jobs in. So in a way, it's like, okay, in terms of just are people working, our job numbers are through the roof. Are people investing? They're doing good. But this seems like it's only putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound, so to speak. We can keep slapping these protectionist policies on every single industry, but I'm worried that we're going to somehow see things have a very negative effect. So while I do think within the first year economically, and I'm talking very vaguely, folks, so I apologize if there's a specific thing I may not have mentioned, but I'd go ahead and say that it stayed still, only because you cannot judge policy simply by the intention. While things might look good now and others will say, okay, I think it shifted upwards, I've got a bad feeling about this one. So I'll say it stayed still.
Yeah, see, I'm going to say it went up, and here's the reason why. And so Trump and the economy is a great example of the Overton window in play, right? I mean, one of Trump's virtues or his vices, on you know, however you intend to see it, is that he drives the left up a wall. It's one of those things that Charlie Sykes kind of mentions, is that, you know, regardless as to where you are in the Republican spectrum, the one thing that unites the whole is anti-liberalism, and there's nobody that exemplifies that best than Donald Trump. And so what you have is a Donald Trump that is literally driving people on along Twitter and anything else. He's sending people into orbit. He's talking about protectionist policies and this, that, and the other. And meanwhile, what you have in the Congress between you know, Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan is you got a really good tax bill coming out of this Congress that the president duly signed. You know, literally overnight, with through the enactment of tax cuts, you know, you have $15 minimum wages. You have bonuses being struck. You had Apple literally say it's going to bring $300 billion in overseas investments back to the United States. If you go back and you look at the credit card the United States whipped out in 2009 in the middle of the Great Recession, that was $900 billion of relief. Apple's literally going to bring a third of that back just by the enactment of smart policies at the congressional level. So even though it seems as if, you know, at the executive level, Trump really isn't doing a whole lot, or the protectionist talk and things like that strikes free marketeers as somewhat obtuse, you do have to go back and look and say, well, the Congress has a hand in this too. They were able to get truly historic tax return or tax reforms coming in. And the tax returns, when they start hitting in February and you start picking up your paychecks, people are going to see the reality of that. And when you start taking a longer gaze and looking at the economy writ large, I mean, automation is going to hit the American workforce like nothing ever before. I mean, 17 to 40% of all the jobs in the United States are going to automate. We are far better off meeting that challenge with an economy that is growing at 4% GDP every year than an Obama-era economy that saw 1% GDP growth as an accomplishment. In that regard, I'm going to give him a thumbs up. I think he's done well.
I agree with 90% of what you said, and I'm so glad you brought up the tax cuts, because as happy as I am, and as happy as my parents are especially, to see more money come home. I mean, I'm for anything and everything that can let people keep more of their own money, because it's yours ultimately. The biggest thing that bugged me about this tax plan, though, and I think I've learned to just kind of ignore it, is the fact that there weren't any matching spending cuts. And I know this might go from economics to federal budgets, but when we look at our $21-22 trillion debt, when we look at the generational debt that is put on millennials and the generation to come after mine, I think it was every newborn child born after the year 2015 has $30,000 of federal debt already, you know, just landing on their lap. So while these tax cuts might be good now, when you don't match that with any type of reduction or anything in terms of federal spending, it just seems like you're kind of kicking a can down the road a bit.
Yeah, it's you know, and to some degree, this is the old, like, the magic of Reaganism, right? I mean, his wisdom was to freeze the denominator, grow the numerator. The best way to handle this question is to freeze government spending, which, I'm necessarily going to say this Congress has really done that. But they are doing a great job at growing the numerator. And that's always been sort of the argument to get out of the hole, is if we have a GDP of 4 to 5%, we're going to be able to cover additional spending and everything's going to be happy. I agree with you, Remzi. I totally agree with you that spending cuts are absolutely critical. There needs to be a much more serious conversation about state debt. You know, you've got the world's eighth largest economy in California. There's a whole ton of debt sitting over there. And it's very easy for those Californians to go ahead and move and get away from a failing government. Somebody's going to eat that debt at the end of the day. And it's literally a canary in a coal mine that is littered with canaries at this rate when it comes to debt spending. And we're literally kicking that can down the road to not just our generation, but to our children's generation and our grandchildren, if they actually have an America to enjoy at that point. So I do wish, and I share with you in that, I really wish Congress would turn its attention towards federal spending and actually making some reductions there. But, you know, first things first, let's do the easy stuff. Let's get the low hanging fruit. We'll tackle the tough questions down the road, hopefully under a Republican Congress.
Definitely. So before we hit our commercial break, just to recap, I said in terms of Trump's first year in terms of economics, I had him in terms of the Overton window at staying still. Sean, you said, you know, upwards.
Upwards. Upwards. Yeah. Upwards and onward.
All right, folks, we're going to go ahead and take our first commercial break. Before I do that, quick words from our sponsor this half hour. Just close your eyes. Think of the perfect world. You know what I think of? I think of my money growing when I sleep. I don't have to do anything. Just let it grow for me. It's like a money tree. It's beautiful. What if I told you, instead of planting a money tree, you can just go ahead and join the program absolutely free? I'm dead serious, folks. Check out joinhelium.com. That's joinhelium.com. What this program does is, with an initial $5 investment, allows your hard-earned money to go ahead and multiply itself long-term with maximum gains and almost non-existent losses. It sounds like it's fake. It sounds like a scam, but the only thing you could do is learn for yourself. So go ahead and check out joinhelium.com. That's joinhelium.com. I'm Remster W. Martinez with the Remster Republic. Stay tuned right after this.
Donate with Bitcoin today at remserrepublic.com/donate.
Join the Remso Republic on Patreon today. Take the show on the go by subscribing to the Remso Republic on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, and YouTube. Don't be left out.
Hello, my name is Alex Merced, and I am a libertarian. I invite you to join me in spreading the message of liberty. Come down to alexmerced.com, where you can find videos and lots of other media to help educate you about liberty and more. I've also created learneconomicsnow.com as a quick way to show anyone the basics about economics. Libertarian101.com, a great starting place to learn what is libertarianism, how to get involved, and how to move things forward. Intro to liberty.com, where you can learn more about how to spread the message of liberty through positive messaging from people like myself, Larry Sharp, and Michael Pickens. And don't forget libertarianpodcast.com, where you can find an exhaustive list of libertarian podcasts for you to enjoy. This is Alex Merced. Follow me on social media such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, and more. And thank you very much.
Hey guys, Tim Preuss here, and I wanted to take a minute and invite you to stop over to PreussPodcast.com and give our show a listen. We've got in-depth commentary on the issues that matter to you.
These hookers. Fucking whores are out there.
These hookers, man, I tell you.
Yeah, that's like the most contact I've had with the hooker.
It's them yelling at you.
Them yelling at me at Twitter.
We break down the most pressing issues of our time.
This what? Large lady with, like, tight clothing on. Not appropriately linked tight clothing either.
And we get the most intelligent analysis from friends of ours like Jeffrey Tucker.
You pulled over engine trouble, and what happened? I don't know.
Seriously, though, we love putting on a show that both entertains and educates. We're growing, and we'd be thrilled if you joined us. Check out PreussPodcast.com for more. That's PreussPodcast.com.
Folks, welcome back to the program. We're going to go ahead and continue our Overton Window discussion of the first year of the Trump administration. Previously, we covered economics, so I kind of want to shift on to another thing that has really, you know, this is the one area where liberals, it seems like the left, they only tend to say anything positive about President Trump when he's bombing another country, and they really tend to foam at the mouth when he's doing something that, quote, embarrasses them. In terms of foreign policy, under Barack Obama, we had an attitude of strengthening our enemies and weakening our allies. It was American appeasement to dictators, fascists, and countries that would burn our flag at a moment's notice. Whereas under President Donald Trump, we have Nikki Haley over at the UN. We have a State Department that actually seems to be, you know, looking at the interests of Americans all across this great land. Instead of a president bowing to the Saudis. We have the Saudis bowing to the president, even around that awkward little glowing globe thing. I'll go ahead and post a picture about that on the show notes. But we saw a president that has overall just completely decapitated ISIS. We're strengthening our military power. But overall, what no one really understands is that diplomatically, Trump has been able to bring down tensions in Syria with Putin. I know, Russian collusion, but, you know, he basically avoided World War III overnight, and no one gave him credit for that. He's gone in front of socialist, communist, Maoist, Marxist, progressives, and essentially said that it's a failed ideology and that we need to go ahead and pursue free markets and an idea of liberty. Not the exact words, but that's basically it in a nutshell. When it comes to putting America first, he's done that, and, you know, I'm pleasantly surprised. So for foreign policy and diplomacy, I'll go ahead and give this Overton window shot upwards momentum.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to do likewise. I mean, definitely upwards. I mean, one of the things that comes to mind with North Korea is that in 2003, we had a kind of an offer on the books to Saddam Hussein that we would quietly ship him to Egypt for $2 billion. And there are some folks at State Department that balked. There was certainly the Iraqis balked it as well, but they were listening, and eventually it didn't turn out that way. Literally trillions of dollars later, we have sunk so much money into the Iraq war. We've received very little for it other than a change of regimes. And now we have a mess, not just in Iraq, but in Syria as well. You know, wouldn't it be interesting if the Trump administration just turned to the Kim Jong-un and said, you know what, we just want to buy your nuke. We'll give you $1 billion for your nuclear weapons.
It's funny you say that, and I'm not joking. I've actually told people, what if we just offer to buy North Korea?
Yeah, just buy the regime. Just say, we're going to give you $1 billion. And in exchange, you have to introduce yourself to the three worst weapons in the American arsenal: McDonald's, jeans, and rock and roll. and if we just employed those weapons, we probably resolve matters in the Korean Peninsula peaceably. You know, Kim Jong-un can ride into the sunset. I'm sure he'd do a lot of great things with $1 billion. But that would be far better solution than ultimately. And you were right. The Third World War we were barreling towards under the Obama administration with this confrontation with North Korea. What could have happened and what is happening now is absolute night and day. And I know that the rhetoric's very strong on this. I do not see the Trump administration provoking conflict in North Korea at any cost, because the cost of that would be untold. I mean, you're talking millions of lives in a regime that will fanatically send them across the border if they could. So, but yeah, definitely a thumbs up, not just in North Korea, but Europe, the Middle East, you know, working on the Iran deal to make that better. Approaches in sub-Saharan Africa, I know that's not exactly a hotbed in the world, but you look at the transition in Zimbabwe, the Trump administration has actually very deftly handled that. It's not as if ZANU-PF has actually left in Zimbabwe, but he's treating them with more carrots and less stick, which ultimately for the people there is that's the best news they could hear. So definitely a thumbs up, probably stronger on foreign policy than I would on economic policy.
I would totally agree. And just, you know, focusing on North Korea, because this is so funny. Lester Holt from, I don't know, whatever network he's from, he was discussing
NBC,
something.
I think, yeah.
NBC. He was doing a piece regarding the joint ski training course lodge that the South Koreans and the North Koreans are both training their Olympic skiing teams at. And he was like, oh, yeah, the North Koreans have treat us of nothing but respect. And he's just, you know, he's basically a mouthpiece for a dictator. But it's so funny because I'm looking at all these South Koreans and these North Korean Olympians training behind him, and I'm like, this is only because of Trump. Like, that is 100% because of Trump. And my biggest sin during the campaign of 2016 was this. I took him literally. I never took him seriously. And for a lot of his diehards, I believe that they took him seriously, but they didn't take him literally. And I think the Rocket Man example, I think that needs to be put in, you know, policy handbooks, because what you had was you had him basically taking someone who we've always treated more seriously than I thought we should have. And he basically exposed him for the fool he was. And North Korea, the only reason why Lester Holt is able to get a nice treatment from the North Koreans and why the South Koreans and North Koreans are having a joint, you know, training center for the Olympics is because they were so deathly afraid of Trump. The North Koreans crawled to that phone to say, hey, South Korea, yeah, we need to have a conversation. Never happens prior. Never happens prior. And coming from, yeah, you know, a Korean family, my mom's side of the family fled, you know, the attacks of the communists in the Korean War. Like, you know, for my grandmother, she was always a big Trump fan. And she was like, only he could take him on. Only he. Never Obama, never Bush, never Clinton. He's the only person that could have ever taken on Kim Jong-il and gotten us this far.
And you do have to give a lot of credit to Secretary Tillerson and Secretary Mattis. I mean, one of the things that the Democrats threw at Tillerson right out of the gate was that he's an oil man. Why would an oil man be a Secretary of State? Well, when you have a multinational the size of ExxonMobil, they've got great intel and they understand the world and the sluices of the world economy. You know, Tillerson was not budging on that. You have Secretary Mattis not necessarily rattling sabers, but just staying quiet, which is probably more terrifying than anything else. And literally overnight, the situation changes there. Nobody's afraid of Barack Obama. I mean, look at everything that happened under just in the last 4 years in the second half of his presidency. Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Jordan had revolts. Qatar had revolts. You had Syria. And literally, we didn't move. We literally broke the 1991 Bucharest Agreement with Ukraine when the Russians went into the Donbass region and annexed the Crimea. Because they knew that Barack Obama was not going to do anything to reverse that condition. And all of a sudden, you have this tremendous sea change and leadership like Tillerson, which had been absent at state for many years under John Kerry, leadership like Secretary Mattis. This is what changes the world at the end of the day. And you've got to give – I mean, I think you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, taking Trump literally but not seriously was a key mistake for many of us, and I'll be one of them to raise my hand and say that I was in that camp. But this is the kind of leadership that has been lacking on the world stage, for many, many years. And finally we're seeing it, and it literally is a breath of fresh air.
Exactly. And you mentioned something incredibly important. It's the fact that, you know, Secretary Mattis has not been saber rattling. That was the greatest fear that many people had with, bringing somebody that had such an extensive military career into the role of Secretary of Defense, because traditionally it had always been set by prior administrations to appoint a civilian to Secretary of Defense to reemphasize the civilian control of the military. But the biggest thing that I think is Mattis's strong suit, and this is something that I don't think many people outside of military communities will understand, is that the last person that ever wants to get people killed without a reason is a soldier, especially an officer. Mm-hmm. And when you look at Mattis and his career, he's had failures and he's had giant successes. But if you want to talk about somebody that actually has a giant understanding of the cost of human life, it's going to be someone that actually had to make those decisions for an entire lifetime. Yeah. And I'm definitely glad that he was not the stereotype the Democrats were trying to paint him as when he was going through Senate proceedings, because I mean, it's they should feel foolish right now. They should be thanking him. They should build a shrine for him in their office, like all those Mattis memes online. I mean, they should be thanking him at this point.
Yeah. A general is typically the last person who wants to send what he loves out to die. And for a lot of the Democrats, they have these visions of Westmoreland where they go into Vietnam and say, well, we need 50,000, now 200,000, now 500,000 troops. And that's sort of what they think a general is. And that hasn't really left that ghost of Vietnam hasn't left them yet. But for conservatives, we still remember, you know, men like, you know, Grant, Lee, Marshall, Patton, Schwarzkopf, Powell. These were I mean, most generals don't fit the liberal narrative. And when you finally get a honest example of that at defense, you know, that you're absolutely right. They ought to just make bobbleheads and send them to every liberal congressman. And that's exactly what they deserve, because that's the one between him, Tillerson and Trump. They should be thanking all three of them, and matters have not escalated on the Korean Peninsula more than what they have under the Obama administration.
Exactly. So before we move on to civil liberties, I'm giving him a giant upwards momentum on the Overton window for foreign policy and diplomacy. And Sean, you said upwards as well?
Upwards.
Perfect. So we're on agreement on foreign policy and diplomacy. Upwards is always good when it comes to this. And I only see it getting better, especially if Trump were to get a second term, which I'm hoping at this point. Now, for civil liberties, this is far more complicated. There's the facade. So what is the facade? We're at giant levels of division, class-wise, race-wise, you name it, there's division. Massive rioting thanks to the Antifa left, giant alt-right protests in Charlottesville with the white nationalists. But that's about it. So that's the facade. And then you have to ask, okay, well, how is Trump responsible for any of that? I would say he's not. When you want to look at civil liberties, I will say that it's definitely sad that Trump did not stop the renewal of this warrantless surveillance program that the NSA has put through. I was deeply disappointed with that. You look at, you know, the expansion of the police state. He has not done anything to necessarily reduce what the Obama administration had set forth. I go ahead and give Obama this, even though he was a giant, you know, fan of militarizing the police. He got rid of that program, which would essentially give the cops tanks to go, you know, give warrants out randomly. When it comes to the war on drugs and other civil liberties, he went ahead and, you know, did something which I, you know, just bothers me. He appointed Jeff Sessions as attorney general. And initially, and this is on the record, folks, when he did that, after living in Alabama for several years, I was like, you know what? Jeff Sessions is a constitutional guy. And he's blatantly said, if you don't like the law, change it. But my job is not to be a living document type of guy. My job is not to be a judicial activist. My job is to enforce the law. And it seems that, you know, Jeff Sessions has done anything but that. He's as much of the judicial activist that he warned us of. So in terms of civil liberties, I'm seeing some good things. But ultimately, I think, you know, when you add the good and the bad together, it kind of keeps things in the middle. I think that, you know, they would have drastically gotten worse if Hillary Clinton had become president. So some might say, well, you know, not going downward is good, but ultimately I haven't seen anything to expand civil liberties in that sense. So I'm going to go ahead and say that for civil liberty issues, Trump has kept us in the middle of the Overton window. Things have kind of just, you know, stayed at a standstill.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to agree with you on this one as well. I mean, look, I mean, we really haven't made any progress. I mean, I'll go further back than warrantless searches and whatnot. I mean, Patriot Act, things of this nature, TSA, we still have these things in place. I mean, yeah, Jeff Sessions, I mean, yeah, he's a lawman. He's, you know, we thought he would be a good constitutionalist and that. It turns out his disdain for the devil's lettuce seems to preoccupy his mind. So, okay, that's fair. You know, there are a number of other things that I wish that the administration would lead on and could lead on at a regulatory level. But I'm not seeing where he's making the status quo worse. So I will at least give him credit for that. But beyond that, I really do wish we'd see a little bit more out of the administration on this front. And of course, yeah, I mean, there are other things to deal with. Tax cuts have been fantastic. How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. But I'm not going to punish him for not making it a priority, although I really do wish that he and the Congress would do so. So I'm going to have to say it's right there in the center and it really hasn't moved.
I will say this. He, drat, what was I going to say? When it comes to this issue, I'm of the school of thought that when it comes to civil liberties, you can't have more individual freedom if you don't have economic freedom. So in a sense, in terms of, you know, do you have more ability to, you know, work and profit in the market? I'll say, you know, that's a good thing. But, you know, and I know that most listeners will probably disagree with me on this. I put immigration in the civil liberties category, because if you don't have a right to protect your property, your life and all that stuff, it doesn't matter. And what we're seeing with the whole DACA situation, the immigration situation, you can't have a country without borders. You can't have a country without understanding who's in it and who's in it for the right reasons. And when it came to this, you know, I was never a fan of the wall when he was president. But it's like, you know, if you were such the hard immigration guy, and even though you're able to get Chuckie Schumer to basically give up after a 2-day government shutdown, we still don't really know what's going on. And what you have been giving towards DACA, Mr. President, is, you know, somewhat more of a sympathetic ear than I would have given. And as it comes to this, whether it was the murder of Kate Steinle, whether it's the rise of MS-13, what we're seeing is Americans are having their life, their liberty, and their property threatened by people that are coming here knowingly, illegally. And I just think that's one of the only major functions of government: protect your people. And on this, I think he's drastically failed.
You know what? I'm going to push back against all of that, right? So the Trump.
I read your op-ed. That's why I brought it up.
so look.
I mean, by the way, exactly, folks, I will link to Sean's op-ed about this. He actually gives a very good argument for this. So find that.
It's
in the show
notes. Heartbreaking work of staggering genius. I know. But but look. Here's what the Trump administration has effectively told Chuck Schumer. And by the way, Chuck Schumer didn't just get beat. I mean, McDonald broke his back in the middle of the public square and then folded him in half again before throwing him away. I mean, Schumer got destroyed. It wasn't even close. So here's what the I'm absolutely tap dancing over it. Sorry. So here's what happens. Right. The administration has been very clear. They want border security. They don't care what it looks like. It can be an actual wall. It can be a digital fence. All they want is for border security to finally be enacted. In exchange for border security, they are willing to bend on DACA, which would be the Dreamers. And so they were willing to say, look, the president's already on record saying he wants some sort of solution on that, whether it's a case-by-case basis or wholesale. He's willing to allow 750,000 Dreamers to remain in the United States and pursue a path for citizenship. The other, 8 to 20 million undocumented workers, that's a different ballgame. And this is where the administration's pushing for an end to chain migration and a whole lot of the other sort of, the laxity that we've seen over the last two decades. But insofar as what the president's trying to achieve, it is in substance the very same sort of immigration reform that Bush pushed for in 2007, that Boehner tried to push for in 2012? And it all fell apart because of, X, Y, and Z. But in this regard, again, a classic Overton window, right? He pushes it all the way to one extreme. Then because the president supports some sort of solution on DACA, people are pretty much at the end of the day when the deal comes through and it's a digital fence and the Dreamers are taken care of, but, everybody else gets red carded. They're going to say, yep, that's what we wanted at the end of the day anyway. And you know what? That is, so long as the solution gets done, I think most Americans are going to be very happy with it.
I could certainly see your points on that. Don't know if I necessarily agree entirely, but yeah, I mean, and you tied it all back together. Expect something at the far end of the window, and even if you go up incrementally, that's still upward. So I'm looking forward to seeing how year two is. So we've covered economics. I said we stay at the middle. Sean went ahead and said that upwards in terms of economics. For foreign policy, we both agreed immensely upwards. And then for civil liberties, things are kind of in the middle. And, this is purely speculatory. But, Sean, year two, what do you think are going to be some of the biggest challenges that the president and his administration is facing?
Well, the biggest challenge they're going to face are the 2018 elections, right? So, right now we're still seeing in special elections across the United States. I mean, we had one in Wisconsin. We had the Virginia election in 2017. We've had, races in Pennsylvania that are looking a little bit closer than they ought to be. There's a narrative being built in the media that the Democrats are going to win this in spades. And we're really not seeing any highlights where the Republicans are going to be able to arrest that. Now, we are seeing that after the passage of tax cuts, we took what was a D18 environment on the generic ballot, and that's now down to about a D5. That's according to a CNN poll. Of all places. So it is improving as the results keep getting done. When you poll on Trump, he polls at about 40%. When you poll on his policies, he actually polls at 60 or 70%. It's like almost like a look at what I do, not at what I say sort of approach. But the real issue of 2018, I think, and this is something that you're going to see as a narrative overall, are judges. The Trump administration has actually done a tremendous job appointing good conservative justices to the federal bench. We've got another 170 to go, and we may very well have not just one but two Supreme Court appointees coming up as Kennedy and Ginsburg begin to make a decision as to what they want to do with the rest of their lives. So holding on to control of the U.S. Senate is going to be absolutely critical in 2018. I think we're going to be okay in the House, believe it or not. And truth be told, because the Democrats – are going to be defending so many seats in the Senate, because bear in mind, 6 years ago was 2012 with the Obama-Romney race, and Obama won that rather handily. There are a lot of Democrats here that have to defend seats in states where Trump won. So we actually have a lot more going for us as a party right now than we believe. It's just that the Democratic narrative is just so red hot and still red hot right now. It's kind of hard to see it. But when you start clearing through the fog, there are actually opportunities for the Republican Party to move forward on this. And so long as we continue to spur the economy, keep it at 4% GDP, keep moving forward on foreign policy, and if we move forward on judges and we make the stakes absolutely clear that there are not just one but two Supreme Court justices up, we've got a better than even shot at making the case that the Republicans can govern and the Democrats can't.
Well, you heard it, folks. Can the Overton window keep its upward climb towards freedom, or will we see a giant rubber band-like backlash in the future? Sean, if people want to track everything you're doing at the Republican Standard more, how could they do so?
You can go ahead and do so at therepublicanstandard.com, or they're free to track us either on Facebook, if you search for the Republican Standard, or on Twitter at TR Standard_VA.
Sean, thank you so much for coming on the program, man. Great discussion.
Thanks for having me, Runza.
Folks, go ahead and do me a favor. Go ahead and follow me on Twitter again. We've got a Minds.com account. If you're not into the fascism at Facebook, I've been loving Minds.com. It's totally like Facebook, but without the scary parts. And go ahead and do me a quick favor. Go ahead and leave me a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play. You know how the internet works. And, you know, keep it coming, folks. You've got so much awesome stuff coming down your way. And if you like discussions like this, you know, a little $1 a month pledge over on Patreon gets you so much exclusive stuff, even non-political things. We've had Would You Rather Wednesday of Dan Smotts every Wednesday. We've had Mystery Pulp Theater and so many other things. Free books, shirts, comics, you name it, we got it. We're having fun over there. As always, be good to your neighbor. Go out and treat yourself a bit and tune in next week, America. I'm Remso W. Martinez. Good night.
Stay up to date with the latest news and updates by visiting
RemsoRepublic.com.
Hey, this is Lloyd Bailey, the Armed Lutheran, host of the Armed Lutheran Radio Podcast, reminding you that the podcast you're listening to is a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. Check out all the great content at selfdefenseradio.net.